David Foster Wallace's infinite jest has become a cultural touchstone that defies easy categorization. This 1,079-page behemoth, written in just 3 years by a writer under 35, has been hailed by literary critics as one of the most important novels of the late 20th century. Celebrities from David Bowie to Zadie Smith have cited it as a transformative reading experience, and its cultural impact continues to grow decades after publication. The novel's prescient vision of entertainment addiction feels eerily prophetic in our smartphone-dominated era, while its exploration of recovery and human connection resonates across generations. Despite its intimidating size, the novel has inspired a devoted following who celebrate Infinite Jest Day annually on the anniversary of its publication. What makes this dense, footnote-laden opus so compelling? Let's dive into the infinite depths of Wallace's masterpiece. The novel opens with a scene chronologically near its end. Hal Incandenza, a tennis prodigy and lexical genius, sits in a university admissions interview at the University of Arizona. Despite his impressive academic credentials, including perfect standardized test scores and athletic achievements at the Enfield Tennis Academy, something is terribly wrong. When Hal speaks, his interviewers perceive only sub-animalistic noises and an awful reaching drumming wriggle instead of coherent speech. This jarring disconnect between Hal's internal experience and others' perception of him establishes one of the novel's central themes, the impossibility of genuine human connection in a world mediated by entertainment and artificial perfection. Wallace masterfully constructs Hal as a character trapped in his own mind, a prison of intellectual brilliance and emotional vacancy. Through carefully crafted flashbacks, we learn that Hal has been raised in an environment of extreme pressure and intellectual cultivation. His mother, Averill, a grammar-obsessed academic known as the Moms throughout the academy, enforces rigid linguistic standards while maintaining an almost pathological need for order. His father, James, a brilliant but alcoholic optical physicist turned avant-garde filmmaker, has created experimental films that both reflect and contribute to his son's psychological complexity. Together, they have molded a prodigy who can, quote, obscure literature and enumerate the rules of grammar, but struggles to express authentic emotion or form meaningful connections. The novel's fractured timeline, jumping between years designated by corporate sponsorship rather than numbers, allows us to witness Hal's gradual disintegration from multiple angles. In earlier chronological scenes, he appears functional but emotionally detached, secretly smoking marijuana in the academy's pump room while maintaining his facade of excellence. His internal monologue reveals a young man who has learned to manipulate emotional variables with clinical precision to satisfy others while feeling far more robotic than John Wayne. This emotional automation is particularly evident in his interactions with his tennis coaches, where he can perfectly mimic the expected responses while remaining internally disconnected. This emotional numbness manifests physically in Hal's recurring nightmares about his teeth crumbling, a powerful metaphor for his deteriorating sense of self and his fear of fundamental dissolution. His dreams often feature him examining his teeth in mirrors, watching them disintegrate while feeling oddly detached from the horror of the experience. As he tells his brother Mario, the only person with whom he shows glimpses of genuine emotion, "I have administrative bones to pick with God," revealing his intellectual approach to even the most profound existential questions. This relationship with Mario serves as a poignant contrast to Hal's other interactions, highlighting what he could be capable of feeling if not for his psychological imprisonment. By structuring the narrative to begin with Hal's ultimate breakdown, Wallace forces readers to question what has happened to this brilliant young man, a mystery that drives much of the novel's narrative tension and serves as a lens through which to examine larger themes of communication, entertainment, and the cost of pursuing perfection in contemporary American society. At the heart of Infinite Jest lies a lethal entertainment cartridge so addictive that viewers become catatonic, unable to do anything but watch it repeatedly until they die of dehydration or starvation. This fictional film, created by Hal's father James Incandenza before his suicide, serves as the perfect metaphor for Wallace's critique of entertainment culture. The film, referred to simply as The Entertainment or The Samizdat, is said to achieve its hypnotic effect through a specific combination of visual angles and recursive imagery that speaks to something primal in the human psyche. The search for this samizdat, a term borrowed from Soviet-era underground publications referring to banned literature distributed in secret, drives much of the novel's espionage subplot. Various political factions, including the wheelchair-bound Quebecois separatist group Les Assassins de Fauteuil Roulant, AFR, seek the master copy to use as a weapon against the Organization of North American Nations, ONAN. The AFR's plan involves mass distributing copies across the United States, effectively weaponizing pleasure itself against the population. Wallace's prescient vision of entertainment addiction feels eerily prophetic in our age of binge-watching and smartphone addiction. The novel depicts a society where 94% of entertainment is consumed at home on high-definition screens, creating a floating no-space world of personal spectation. People have become so isolated by private entertainment that they paradoxically develop a new passion for public gatherings, spectops, where crowds form to witness real-life events like accidents or civic activities, seeking the fellowship and anonymous communion of being part of a watching crowd. These gatherings become a desperate attempt to reconnect with reality and other humans in a world dominated by private consumption. The Samizdat's victims mirror modern technology addiction with disturbing accuracy. As one character describes, viewers become reduced to roughly the mental/spiritual energies of a moth, completely consumed by desire for more viewing. Even test subjects from federal prisons succumb immediately, unable to describe the content beyond a veiled woman going through revolving doors. Medical reports in the novel detail the progression of symptoms, initial fascination, followed by complete withdrawal from all other activities, and finally a vegetative state where victims can only repeat certain phrases from the film. Through this fictional entertainment, Wallace asks profound questions about pleasure, choice, and free will. As Marathe, an AFR operative, argues with American agent Steeply in a crucial philosophical dialogue, if Americans truly possess self-restraint, why would the government fear the entertainment's dissemination? The vulnerability to this addictive entertainment reveals a fundamental inability to resist immediate pleasure, a cultural death that precedes physical collapse. The Samizdat becomes a metaphor for all forms of addiction, suggesting that the pursuit of pleasure without limits ultimately leads to self-destruction. This theme resonates throughout the novel's parallel narratives about drug addiction, competitive athletics, and academic achievement, all exploring different facets of American society's relationship with pleasure and consumption. In stark contrast to the intellectual elitism of Enfield Tennis Academy stands Ennett House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House, a halfway facility at the bottom of the hill. Here, Wallace explores addiction and recovery through characters who have hit rock bottom and are struggling towards sobriety one day at a time. Don Gately, a former burglar and Demerol addict, emerges as the novel's unlikely moral center. Despite his massive size and criminal past, Gately demonstrates a humility and commitment to recovery that makes him the novel's most authentically heroic figure. Working as a live-in staff member at Ennett House, he navigates the chaos of early recovery, mediating conflicts, enforcing rules, and cooking simple meals like boiled hot dogs, meatloaf, and overcooked spaghetti that residents complain about but respect. Wallace brilliantly captures the language and culture of Alcoholics Anonymous, depicting meetings where speakers share their stories of initial pleasure, diminishing returns, mounting losses, failed attempts to control use, and finally, complete surrender. What unites Boston AA members is their common desperation and shared shock when they discover the program inexplicably works, though nobody can explain how sitting in folding chairs, listening to cliches, keeps them sober. Through Gately's perspective, we learn that Boston AA has a subtle but rigid structure beneath its non-authoritarian facade. The program insists there are no musts, only suggestions. But as Gately sponsor Francis G. jokes, these suggestions are like recommending a parachute when jumping from a plane. Recovery requires surrendering to people who know how to starve the spider, the disease, explaining why committed AA members become humble, kind, and patient. The novel's most moving passages describe Gately's transformative experience of having his craving for narcotics mysteriously lifted after following the program's suggestions, daily prayer on his knees despite feeling like a hypocrite. When he suddenly realizes he hasn't thought about drugs in quite some time, he's confused. How could a higher power he doesn't believe in remove his compulsion when he'd been merely going through motions? This paradox of recovery, that it works even when you don't understand how, becomes a powerful counterpoint to the novel's themes of intellectual analysis and control. The Incandenza family serves as the novel's dysfunctional epicenter, each member embodying different responses to trauma and emotional isolation. James O. Incandenza, the family patriarch, was a child tennis prodigy pushed by his failed actor father before becoming a brilliant optical physicist and experimental filmmaker. His suicide by putting his head in a microwave oven occurs before the novel's main action but haunts every aspect of the narrative. Avro Incandenza, Hal's mother, is a grammar-obsessed academic with obsessive-compulsive tendencies and a pathological fear of confinement. Their home lacks interior doors. Her extreme politeness masks manipulation that her eldest son, Oren, describes as holding her feelings like a terrorist with a hostage. After her husband's suicide, she forms an inappropriate relationship with her student, John Wayne, the Academy's top tennis player. Oren, the eldest son, escapes the family by becoming a professional football punter and serial womanizer. His relationships follow a predictable cycle of excitement, hope, acquisition, contempt, as he seeks to feel for just one moment that he is the one to each subject he seduces. His inability to maintain genuine connections stems from unresolved issues with his mother and the trauma of his father's suicide. Mario, the middle son, has physical disabilities, including dwarfism, withered arms, and a lurching gait. Despite these challenges, he possesses an emotional authenticity that makes him beloved by everyone at ETA, where people just vaguely prefer it when you're around. His innocence and genuine spirituality, his hour-long nightly prayers are not a chore, but more like a conversation, provide a moral compass lacking in most other characters. Through this family's complex dynamics, Wallace explores how genius and dysfunction intertwine. James's obsession with optical physics and filmmaking came at the expense of emotional connection with his children. Hal inherited his father's brilliance, but struggles with the emotional emptiness it created. As Hal reflects, his mother Avro hears only her own echoes inside him, making him profoundly lonely despite his academic and athletic success. Wallace creates a dystopian near-future North America, reorganized as the Organization of North American Nations, ONAN, a political entity formed through the territorial reconfiguration engineered by President Johnny Gentle. A germophobic former crooner turned politician, Gentle campaigned on promises to find some cohesion-renewing other to blame for America's problems and to make tough choices for a whole new North America. The novel's political satire centers on Gentle's solution to America's waste management crisis, forcibly gifting a toxic territory along the U.S.-Canadian border to Canada, creating the Great Concavity, called the Great Convexity by Canadians. This toxic wasteland is maintained through annular fusion, a process that bombards radioactive particles with toxic waste to create stable compounds. The paradoxical effect makes the eastern concavity uninhabitably lush, requiring regular toxic waste dumps to prevent overgrowth. This environmental catastrophe fuels Quebec separatism, particularly the violent wheelchair-bound terrorists Les Assassins de Fauteuils Roulants, AFR. Their quest to obtain the lethal entertainment represents their ultimate weapon against Onan, planning to distribute it across America and let citizens choose their own destruction through their inability to resist pleasure. The novel's political themes culminate in philosophical debates between AFR operative Maroth and American agent Steepley about freedom, choice, and national character. Maroth argues that America's fundamental weakness is its citizens' inability to resist pleasure even when fatal. This is why choosing is everything. He distinguishes between freedom from, absence of constraint, and freedom to, ability to choose wisely, using the metaphor of a father who lets his child eat only candy. Through these political elements, Wallace explores how pleasure and entertainment become matters of national security. The corporate sponsorship of calendar years, year of the Depend adult undergarment, year of the Whopper, represents the complete commercialization of time itself, while the government's fear of the entertainment reveals the fragility of a society built on consumption and immediate gratification. Enfield Tennis Academy serves as more than just a setting. It's a philosophical laboratory where Wallace explores the psychology of excellence, competition, and self-transcendence. The Academy's demanding regimen pushes students to physical and mental extremes, creating what one character calls the suffering that unites us. Coach Gerhard Schitt approaches tennis philosophically rather than technically, seeing it as a mathematical infinity of choices contained within boundaries of skill and imagination. Unlike most coaches who focus on statistics and technique, Schitt views tennis as not order, limit, the places where things broke down, fragmented into beauty. He teaches that the true opponent is the player himself, not the person across the net, making tennis an essentially tragic enterprise where players seek to vanquish and transcend the limited self whose limits make the game possible. This philosophical approach to tennis mirrors Wallace's broader exploration of what it means to excel at anything. As Teddy Schacht reflects, competitive tennis is largely mental once players reach a certain skill level, requiring both caring deeply and not caring at all to succeed. This paradox appears throughout the novel. True mastery requires both obsessive dedication and the ability to transcend that obsession. The novel's most vivid exploration of this theme comes in Tennis and the Pharaoh Prodigy, a second-person instructional monologue that details the ritualistic preparations and psychological burdens of prodigious talent. It describes talent as a dark gift and explains that escaping into pure play only increases expectations. The monologue emphasizes that tennis is fundamentally about managed fear and sending from yourself what you hope will not return. Through the Academy's competitive hierarchy, Wallace also explores how excellence isolates. Top players like Howe and John Wayne exist in a rarefied atmosphere where their worth depends entirely on performance. When Howe nearly loses to the younger Ortho the Darkness Stice, he experiences an existential crisis about his identity and future. This pressure creates what Poutrincourt calls the two dooms facing those who reach the pinnacle. Either the shocking realization that attaining their goal doesn't provide the meaning they expected, or the syndrome of the endless party, where players become celebrities obsessed with celebrating their success through excess. Throughout Infinite Jest, Wallace grapples with language's inadequacy to express human experience. This theme manifests most dramatically in Howe's university interview, where his attempts to speak produce only horrifying noises, despite his belief he's communicating normally. This disconnect between intention and reception represents the novel's central communication crisis. the novel abounds with characters struggling to express themselves. Kate Gompert cannot adequately describe her depression to her psychiatrist, explaining that clinical terms like anhedonia fail to capture her experience of a sense of radical and thoroughgoing evil that pervades existence. Don Gately, after being shot, must communicate through writing when a breathing tube prevents speech, finding his thoughts too complex for his limited writing skills. Wallace explores different linguistic communities with their specialized vocabularies, the technical jargon of tennis, the therapeutic language of recovery programs, the political rhetoric of separatism, and the academic discourse of film theory. Each vocabulary creates both connection among insiders and barriers to outsiders, demonstrating language's double-edged nature. The novel's most poignant communication failures occur between family members. James Incandenza creates the lethal entertainment in a desperate attempt to reach his son Hal, whom he believed was mute to him despite Hal's insistence he could speak. This tragic misunderstanding reflects the novel's recurring theme that we can never truly know another's internal experience. Wallace's own linguistic virtuosity, from technical descriptions of tennis mechanics to the street vernacular of addicts, demonstrates both the possibilities and limitations of language. His extensive use of endnotes and specialized vocabulary mirrors the novel's concern with information overload and the fragmentation of knowledge in contemporary society. The character Lyle, a guru who sits atop a towel dispenser in ETA's weight room and literally lives off students' sweat, offers one of the novel's most profound insights on communication. Let not the weight thou wouldst pull to thyself exceed thine own weight. This advice applies not just to weightlifting, but to all attempts to reach others. We can only communicate what we have the capacity to carry ourselves. In a world saturated with entertainment and mediated experiences, Infinite Jest explores the desperate search for authenticity. Mario Incandenta, despite his physical limitations, represents the novel's moral center precisely because of his unfiltered emotional honesty. During his nighttime walks around campus, Mario appreciates the recovering addicts at Ennett House who cry in front of each other and say God with a straight face, recognizing an authenticity lacking at ETA. The novel contrasts different approaches to authenticity through its characters. Hal's intellectual brilliance allows him to analyze and mimic genuine emotion without experiencing it. Oren's seductions create momentary connections that quickly dissolve into contempt. Joelle Van Dyne, also known as Madame Psychosis, hides behind a veil as part of UHID, Union of the Hideously and Improbably Deformed, paradoxically hiding openly by acknowledging her shame about wanting to hide rather than hiding the shame itself. The recovery community offers the novel's most compelling model of authenticity through its emphasis on surrender and honesty. AA meetings feature speakers sharing stories that follow the same trajectory, creating connection through shared vulnerability rather than intellectual posturing. The program works precisely because it requires members to abandon pretense and admit powerlessness, a radical act in a culture obsessed with control and image. Wallace explores how technology complicates authenticity through his prescient critique of video telephony. In a hilarious digression, he describes how videophone technology initially thrived but quickly collapsed as users became enslaved to vanity, developing increasingly sophisticated masks and eventually transmittable tableaus, essentially doctored photographs of attractive people resembling the caller only in race and limb number. This evolution ultimately led people back to audio-only phones, preferring the freedom from visual scrutiny that allowed them to multitask during conversations, a eerily accurate prediction of our contemporary relationship with technology. Through these explorations, Wallace suggests that authentic connection requires vulnerability, presence, and acceptance of limitations. The characters who find moments of genuine connection, like Gately with his AA sponsor or Mario with his brother Hal, do so by embracing rather than denying their imperfections and dependencies. Infinite Jest ultimately reveals life as a series of recursive loops, addiction and recovery, pleasure and pain, connection and isolation, that resist linear progression or neat resolution. The novel's structure mirrors this theme, beginning near its chronological end and circling through multiple timelines without providing conventional closure. This recursive quality appears most vividly in the novel's treatment of addiction. As Boston AA members learn, recovery isn't a linear journey, but a daily recommitment that never ends. The program works as the reverse of addiction. Substances initially seem perfect, but inevitably fail you. AA initially seems ridiculous, but improbably works. This paradoxical pattern, worse in a way that's somehow better, leaves recovering addicts flummoxed but free. The novel's title itself references both Shakespeare's Hamlet, "Alas, poor Yarick, a fellow of infinite jest," and the lethal entertainment that creates an infinite loop of pleasure from which viewers cannot escape. This double meaning suggests that art itself occupies an ambiguous position, potentially either liberating or enslaving, depending on how we engage with it. Wallace's most profound insight may be that breaking these recursive loops requires accepting rather than denying them. Don Gately's breakthrough comes when he realizes he can manage his pain by living completely in the moment, building walls around each second rather than projecting into an unbearable future. This present moment awareness, what AA calls the present that is truly a gift, offers a path forward that acknowledges life's recursive nature without being trapped by it. The novel concludes without resolving its central mysteries: what happened to Hal, whether the lethal entertainment was contained, how various characters' stories intersect. This deliberate ambiguity forces readers to confront their own desire for neat resolution and entertainment, inviting us instead into a more complex relationship with narrative that mirrors life's own unresolved nature. In its sprawling, encyclopedic approach to human experience, Infinite Jest ultimately suggests that meaning emerges not from escaping life's recursive loops, but from engaging them with awareness, compassion, and the courage to remain present even when presence feels unbearable. As Gately learns through his recovery, no single instant is unendurable. What's unbearable is thinking about all the instants stretching ahead. By choosing to live in the endless now, we find not an escape from life's complexity, but a way to bear it.